Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Envision Podcast. My name is Karthik and I am your host for today's episode. On this podcast, we bring together people from across the world who have a positive impact on the blind and visually impaired community and share their stories with you. Today with me, I have James Drath, who is a legally blind filmmaker, and he uses technology to help him pursue his passion for filmmaking. James is actually one of the most inspiring creators we have come across in the community. He creates awesome YouTube videos. He consults on tech, gaming, and so much more. He's even had coffee with Apple CEO Tim Cook, which we will get to at some point in the episode. So welcome, James. We're really happy to have you with us here today.
Hi. Yeah, thank you for having me today. It's a pleasure to have just take the time to be on this podcast. I've heard great things.
All right. Awesome. So, James, I'd like to start off at the beginning. I want you to give us a little bit of a peek into your story and what made you James Drath, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many elements to this. Technically, yeah. So I was born legally blind with ocular albinism, and that triggered nystagmus as well, which is very present in my vision. So I see quite often when I'm trying to look straight on at something, within half a second, it's already starting to like sway or shake. That image is then pretty much distorted. And then with the albinism, the vision already like lacks pigment, so it's got like high light sensitivity. So my eyes can actually start to physically hurt from too much light intake, and even just from straining them, trying to use them too much. So over the years, I've learned to sort of adapt to other ways of, you know, processing sensory information, whether it's using my ears or sense of touch. And I will obviously keep my eyes open, but what I try to do is just not focus with them when I don't have to. So I, you know, at least have this bare, blurry image to sort of reference in my brain, along with the sounds and whatever it is I'm interacting with. So that's a little bit about like how I see and how I'm typically processing info. And then in terms of how I got into filmmaking, well, at a young age, I came across a camera in my parents' basement. And I was kind of just fascinated. I knew like my parents were always filming every kind of event, birthdays, Christmas, whatever it may be. And I had never been able to be on the other side of that, you know, looking into the lens. My parents aren't like filmmakers or anything. My dad, at least if anything, has a brief history with movie making back in the 70s or so. Him and his friends, neighborhood friends, and his brothers would, they had like a Super 8 camera, and they would be making little movies, creating dummies that they would like blow up or take like all these action figures and then like army men and stuff. And so they were like the pioneers in their neighborhood, at least, of being on the cutting edge of home movies. And two of those guys actually went out to Hollywood and worked on big things like the Spider-Man trilogy from Sam Raimi, things like Soul Surfer, I think it was. And yeah, just some really incredible blockbusters. Wizards, the Great and the Powerful, or Oz, Great and the Powerful from the universe, I think, of Wizard of the Oz. So anyway, I had that as inspiration when I was younger, to kind of like this influence of people who were, you know, friends with my dad, who were coming to visit, you know, fairly close family friends, who would tell me about what it's like. Like, they just wrapped up a movie. They were telling me all about like how they made the visual effects and then what it was like to be on set. And, you know, I'm about 8 to 9 years old around that time, and I was just fascinated by it all. So when I came across this camera without adult supervision, this expensive home video camera that I know I shouldn't be touching, I couldn't help myself. And I'm glad I couldn't, because I turned it on and I, you know, had like a friend over at the time, and we were just kind of messing with it. And I realized that I could zoom in and peak focus. And at this point in time, I never thought about the vision that I didn't have. And, you know, I'm still like, I'll talk more about my mindset later on this, but I was fascinated about the things that were there that I couldn't see in detail. I'm never, at least today, looking for a cure or anything. I think it gets kind of a waste of time personally. I have life to live. And then I like to just have things accessible for and work cooperatively with the vision that I have or lack thereof. And I realized that this camera was, it was like my first taste of accessibility. I was able to pull focus and change the ISO and the aperture to essentially change the lighting conditions to better fit like my eyes. And I could just zoom in and see details around the room and around the world that I didn't know were there. So it was really cool experience for an 8-year-old to sort of discover that, who most of the world, you know, that he could see was really 2 inches from his eyes, with straining them, and everything else was just this big blur of an environment. So that's a little bit about like, yeah, the more detailed story of how I got into like, you know, interested in filmmaking.
Interesting. And that kind of segues into my next question, right? Because you mentioned that as a kid, you were aware of being someone who's visually impaired and also being very different from your schoolmates. What was the feeling growing up when you realized you didn't really fit well, or you didn't fit into what was the traditional person at your school? Were you feeling different from the crowd, or was it being an outsider? Because I think that also feeds a lot into your art and your life, right?
Yeah. So for me, it was a little bit of a, I want to say, fairly long acceptance journey. Mm-hmm. And again, I never had any issues with the visual impairment until it really became an issue for some ignorant kids. Again, not everyone was like this. And there was just a few, honestly, you kind of say, just whether you want to call them low life or just kids who probably didn't come from like the best, most accepting home environment. Like, this is just me kind of judging based on their character that they brought to school for several years. Mm-hmm. But there was just a small group of just kids at my public school who decided, well, I don't like looking at you and seeing your eyes shake back and forth. I'm going to threaten you. I'm going to, it got pretty harsh. They wanted to basically say like, I'm going to bring a golf club to school and smack you over the head with it until your eyes stop shaking. And this kind of came about when I was just having a normal conversation with them on the bus. And suddenly, I don't know, just something kind of triggered in them that like got very, just vile. It got very, dark and kind of like, in a sense, like evil, like this terrible mindset, towards me and just because I had a disability or my, you know, I was different. And again, most majority were not like this, but this kid and his small little group of friends decided to just, yeah, harass me for a few days until it kind of got to a point where I did think worse about myself. And I got to a pretty dark place, and this is only when I was 11 years old. So very, very young. And yeah, I don't want to get kind of too much into that story. So if I gloss over some darker details, kind of keep it a little lighter. It got to a point where I wanted to change. I wanted to fix my vision, fix my eyes, stop them from being noticeable when they shake. And it's really unhealthy to think like that for by that time I was 12. Mm-hmm. Because I couldn't accept myself and who I was and you know how I was born, and it's kind of dangerous to, specifically with my visual condition, sort of try and correct that, because the only things that really can are very, and it's not even guaranteed, let alone like, it's more so just potential treatment, but that's to get like experimental surgery, and I did get that. Essentially, this was surgery that was to try and like stop the eye shaking involuntarily. And it's not practiced today. It's not available because I think it got shut down. I think this was originally pioneered by a guy at the University of Irvine Health. I can't remember the doctor's name exactly, but he wasn't the one that performed it on me, but he started it, and he was doing like decades long tests to see how his patients and their nystagmus was being treated over the years. And there was some improvement in some people, but again, for me, I did get it. So I will say that I did get the surgery, and my vision had went from about 2300, and that's like sort of at its best, to 150, and then it progressively even got better down to like what's still considered visually impaired but not legally blind anymore, and that was like 20 over 100. Mm-hmm. And they believe that I could potentially drive. This is, again, when I was around the age of like 12 going on to 14. And I could potentially take the written driver's ed course. And then if my vision was to get better, they would actually, you know, see how that goes. But that didn't last long. It actually, overnight, my vision decreased back to legal blindness after about 3 years. It was about 2.5 years, really. But yeah, that just all went away. And then we went to the eye doctors a few days later to kind of see what's going on after getting that confirmation. We talked about like we could potentially get that surgery again, but it's dangerous. You know, it could cause permanent damage, worse blindness, you know, from what I had and known. And it wasn't worth it to me. Probably my parents too. And I came to sort of accept myself, my situation. And I think I realized like, if I'm meant to have this vision for whatever reason, there's probably a reason for it. And that's, you know, we can kind of get into more of the, you know, higher up thinking on that. But
yeah,
essentially I encountered that bully again. Funny enough, I never had any classes with him after getting that surgery. And I never even really encountered him at school, maybe a pass by here once or twice, but I suddenly got into a class with him the year that my vision reverted back to what it was during the second half of that year. And the dude didn't change. This was 3 years later. We're in high school now. And he was still the exact same person that he was when he was 11. And I think that's when I realized I'm above this. I'm above you. I'm above all that. And yeah, that was pretty much like my journey with dealing with how my vision was influenced negatively on certain individuals. I wouldn't even say, you know, I wouldn't even maybe word it like that, but more so some people are just not good people and don't have much going for them. So they take it out on you and try to point out your flaws. And yeah, I think my best advice to anyone who's maybe going through that in school right now or may in the future, you're above it. You're above all that. And you don't owe anyone anything or an answer because of who you are. Yeah, so that's pretty much my journey
with
dealing with outside influence with my vision.
Yeah, because the work that you put out today, the life that you live out today is quite an answer to a lot of the bullies and generally people who doubt folks who are either disabled or have other kind of disabilities. And that ties in really well with what my next question was, because when I speak to a lot of people, they go through these really transformative phases, sometimes both good and bad, to get to what their real purpose ends up becoming. And my question was around the time that this was happening, when you really discovered technology, filmmaking, and you started to take that up more seriously. It is really interesting for a lot of people who are listening to this podcast to understand how can a blind filmmaker come out to be? What can their creative process be like? And to take one example, I watched a Tommy Hilfiger campaign, great stuff, by the way, because when I see the shots, it really is impossible for a lot of people that I showed it to believe that it was actually made by someone who was visually impaired. You really broke a lot of boundaries.
Yeah, thank you for the kind words on that. That was one of the coolest things I've ever done. And it wasn't just about creating a cool film. It was about representing people like me and younger people, you know, in ways that I feel like we're not well enough represented in media. And, you know, that can kind of go back to where maybe some bullying stems from. You know, people who don't understand tend to try to draw a line between you and them, right? People who don't want to understand or make an effort to. And that's where you get this opposition view of, you know, who you are from other people. And so when I set out to work on that campaign, my goal was to, like, we have this great brand, right? Tommy Hilfiger, and they're also investing a lot, and they spent years on this camp on this new line of clothing that is for people with disabilities to independently dress themselves. I think when you think a lot about people who have, whether it's physical disabilities or even visual impairments, you may not think about like even the first steps in the morning, getting dressed. And that can be a struggle for many people. I know for me, it's, you know, not as difficult as it is for others. I mean, the worst I tend to, I've walked out of the apartment with a shirt on backwards for sure. But that's pretty much, I guess the worst thing I deal with sometimes are zippers and sometimes buttons, depends on a thing. But Tommy Hilfiger figured that out, which is great. And what made him actually want to make this line of clothing is he's got two boys with autism. And getting dressed in the morning for them was, it was a chore. So he set out to, like, he's a renowned clothing designer, but his own boys, like, were having a tough time wearing his clothes. And he saw that, okay, clothes are not universally designed. And that was sort of where he had to go back to the drawing board. And he worked with Open Style Lab, which is a foundation, a charity that, nonprofit that consults and works to help be inclusive with design, especially in fashion and clothing. They do a lot of brilliant work and fantastic organization. I just always happy to plug and give kudos to. And they worked with Possible, which is now the Wunderman Thompson agency, who are known to work with like Microsoft on the adaptive controller for Xbox. So they got the right people involved. And then one way or another, this came across to me through a production company that I was just kind of talking to with another project and called me back in, and we got it, which is there's some very stiff competition for this commercial. So it was a major win for that, but it was also just a major win because the people who we had involved were just so talented, and they were all disabled. Like, that's the thing. Like, they wanted to come in. We auditioned people with disabilities. We found over, I think it was about 120 within a week, people who came in and auditioned. We also took some remote auditions as well, and we flew some people out. So it was a really tough decision because some people had some amazing stories, some awesome styles, great personalities, and we really just wanted to capture that. That was kind of key. But also getting a good diverse age range was also important because, sure, Tommy's clothing first launched with kids' clothes. I don't know the specifics. I imagine it's maybe more affordable and easier to pilot a clothing line for kids, less material and stuff. And that's why, like, Target, I think Zippo, I can't remember the...
There's Zappos. Another
brand. Yeah. Zappos, yeah.
Yeah.
They were all launching with kids first. And of course, there was like a lot of people from the community like, oh, this is amazing, but adults also want to get dressed too. but, it was being worked on. It was coming. That was like, we had Lolo Spencer, who is brilliant, amazing. And after that commercial, went on to work on like an award-winning film called... oh my gosh, I went to the premiere. Sorry, I'm not the best with names and titles, to be honest. Like, this is my brain. But it's amazing. Look up Lauren Spencer. It's at the tip of my tongue. Regardless, what was really key was just trying to represent people with disabilities in ways that wasn't inspirational, but rather just living their life, doing their thing. We had one boy named Gavin who went on to be on a TV show. I think it was 911 after that. It was like a law enforcement drama kind of soap opera kind of show. But he surfed. He did surfing therapy for his CP. And that was so cool. We met his surfing instructor at the audition. We brought him in. We weren't sure if we were going to include that. But I'm like... how can we not? This is such an LA thing for like people with disabilities to just go off and like surf in Malibu every Friday for like, you know, therapy and stuff. It's really cool, like physical therapy. But too, and like, think of that shot. And that was our ending shot. We finished at Venice Beach, We got some surfing shots. We did some skate park shots. It was just I really just wanted to set out to show some really cool people who have a disability and had really cool passions too, and how the clothes of Tommy Hilfiger, you know, adaptive, can get them from point A to point B, get them to where they want to be, just that much faster, more independent. We also featured a blind skateboarder, which I think was really awesome. There's a couple actually in LA, but this dude was young. He was about 14 or 15. But his story was cool because he made his own boards with his dad. It was like a bonding experience that they did. So we featured one of his, he had his own skateboard that he made with his dad in their garage, in the commercial. Again, just there's some really cool tidbits to like each little person in this commercial. And I can't wait to like, I hope we can do more, whether it's with Hilfiger or another company, but I just, there's so many people from those auditions that like, I want to work with that, you know, we just didn't have 60 seconds, right? We couldn't include everyone, but again, such a great community. And I think that's why it's like so important to audition and try to even like feature and consult with people with disabilities in media. It's because we're lived experiences. You know, if you're trying to write or have a character with a disability, you're not going to capture the same realistic performance from an able-bodied actor. You just can't, because disabled people are there's a lot of talented disabled people. And even if you have to like rewrite the role a little bit to get that right person, whether it's like age or the look or whatever, do it. Because I think if you're trying to really capture, you know, a disability as a attribute to this character or their story or whatever, and you know, there's also more arguments of like how to write that properly, but it's so key and important to give like real auditions to people with disabilities to come in and potentially give that role to them, because you'll probably have a better performance out of it.
No, I think there is, you know, some truth to that statement for sure. And what I really loved about the Tommy Hilfiger ad was what you mentioned early on. It wasn't really trying to sound inspirational, but the fact that you had all these people trying to go out and do the things that they want to do despite their disabilities is what really stood out to me as well. And I felt that it was the case with that particular, you know, video, simply because it was you who was directing it and you were trying to just project people as they were, as against trying to make something really inspirational out of it. And I think that's where the video hits home to me and a lot of other people who work in the accessibility space. You see people trying to go out and just do the things that everyone else is trying to do. They do have this additional barrier to cross, and sometimes technology helps them get there. And it kind of segues into my, you know, the next part of what I wanted to talk with you was about accessibility technology. And when I went through your YouTube channel, that seems to play a huge part in your life. And you are a very tech savvy person from what I can see. How does that tie into your life? And when did that really start? When did the fascination with accessibility tech really start for you?
I think it kind of goes back to that first story, the camera. You know, being involved in video production, you kind of need to be on top of things to some degree when it comes to knowing about, you know, because video production, it's a pretty technical art form, but especially when you go into video editing as well. And I think we all need to have some sort of skill set of tech savviness if we are trying to work, especially in this more so digital age more than ever now, just understanding how like computers work and how, you know, different files and whatever, however much basic knowledge that you can get. And there's so many free resources out there. You've got to be willing to listen and learn. I think it really kind of goes back to that camera. I needed to sort of be on top of it. And then as I was exposed early on to newer forms of accessibility, like digital accessibility, such as like VoiceOver on the Mac, screen reader, and the Zoom capability. And then back in the day when I was a Windows user, you know, I got a copy of Zoom Text through the state and my school. So Zoom Text at home also was like another early form. But yeah, just knowing how these work, I think it was important. I used to edit video with ZoomTex enabled on Windows Movie Maker. And it was still kind of an eyesore at times. It wasn't the most intuitive experience. And then eventually I went to the Mac, learned iMovie. Apple's Zoom, I think, is top-notch. It's A-plus quality for me, and it keeps getting better. They're, like, I don't know how it keeps getting better, but recently, in the last year or two, they introduced, like, take three fingers, double tap on a touchpad. So you can do this on a MacBook or on the Magic Trackpad if you have that for your desktop Mac. By just double tapping with one hand with three fingers, you can just start zooming, and you can drag that zoom as in like changing the amount of zoom just by sliding. And it works just like how it does on like an iPhone or iPad whenever you don't use the zoom controller, but rather it's the gesture. It's brilliant. It works so easy for me when I'm trying to video edit and I need to zoom out of something, zoom back into something very fast on the fly. People who look over my shoulder when I'm editing get a massive headache. A lot of sighted people, they can't keep up with how much I'm zooming in and out and like where I'm going. So yeah, that's really, I think, video production and accessibility technology and that evolving really what fuels my interest in technology and the potential. For anyone who's like heard me talk about it, I love augmented reality. I think like that has so much potential application use for visually impaired and blind people. Between augmented reality and AI and even virtual reality to some degree, especially as I'm someone who can see slightly more detail when things are up close to my face. So I have actually looked through VR lenses before, and VR kind of, you know, sort of kind of works. I think you got to like maybe play with the font sizes and, you know, how much is happening at once, but it's close to my face and I can sort of see. I got to be careful probably with how much focus and vision I really, like for my eye stamina, I put in without getting a migraine, but it's a really cool technology. And I think specifically AR and AI together, once we get like a really good mainstream hands-free, could be glasses, whatever, head mount of AR that is just like able to interact with the real world, whether it's maps or mapping how far people are from you. And Apple sort of put some of this technology recently with the LiDAR sensor and the iPhone 12 Pro, yeah. Pro Max, where it's able to just instantly tell you like, hey, person 6 foot away on your left or person 3 feet away. So like, think about that hands-free, that kind of technology hands-free when you're just trying to like go around the grocery store. Like it's great, especially if hopefully we don't, but in the future where if there's another pandemic or worst case scenario, just another public health crisis and you can keep your distance So yeah, I think it's really amazing, and that's where I'm interested in. That's why I just want to keep learning more about technology and featuring it, because the more I do it, the more I learn and watch it progress. And a lot of this tech is still early, but it's like it's getting there.
Yeah, and I think I've had guests on this show talk a lot about AI, and I think you're the first person to talk about AR, which is really what excites personally, because I get to work on Envision, which is related to AI, and now we have the Envision glasses, and I know expectantly we're all waiting for someone like Apple and Google to come in and make smart glasses or some kind of hands-free computing a lot more mainstream and how much potential that's going to have. And speaking of Apple, I definitely have to talk about that whole meeting with Tim Cook and what all went into it. And if you had a rare sneak peek that most of us don't get to have from Apple, because you made a video and then you were invited to come talk to Tim about your experience. What was that experience like going and meeting someone like Tim Cook, you know, all the technology that you use, and all of a sudden you meet the CEO of the company?
Yeah, I've got a pretty good relationship with Apple, as you know, I go out to the iPhone events and I've been to WWDC, and I kind of get to overstay my welcome sometimes and just meet developers and chat with them and do some coverage like I did not last year. Well, I talked to last year about it, but it was virtual. But in 2019, I got to meet some developers, some young people too, who were like working on some really cool apps for accessibility purposes. One dude who was actually visually impaired, and he was working on an app to simulate different visual conditions, which is really neat. And so, you know, there's only so much I can really share because there's obviously like NDAs and stuff and things kind of behind the scenes. But that kind of came about because specifically the Tim Cook interview, I made a video called How Apple Saved My Life. And I know that may sound like a stretch when you first read that title or hear it. But it's kind of true. When you watch I made a short film back in 2016 talking about that time in my life where I was, you know, dealing with bullies and feeling kind of down on myself. And at the same time, I had a hard time keeping up in school. And then once I was introduced to a Mac, that kind of flipped everything for me. I was really struggling, right? And like when your education, which is what a kid's doing 40 hours a week, if not technically more, 60 hours when you count homework and assignments and stuff, when that's not accessible, it really impacts your self-esteem, your mental health, and makes you kind of feel like you're failing. Like not just your schoolwork, but you're failing yourself and your future. Which isn't a good feeling. It's a lot to kind of cope with. And when I was able to actually get a Mac in the classroom, along with an iPhone, suddenly what I was doing was I was screenshotting. I was using Scanner Pro at the time, and I actually still like this app today. I know there's so many more in terms of competition that can do this, but I would scan it, a document, a class assignment, and I would send it through email to my school email, which was using Google organization, like G Suite or something at the time. And that would open up in Google Docs. Google Docs already had like OCR built in for character recognition. And it was able to pick up on the text from that PDF image or JPEG, however I sent it. So it was able to pick up on the actual text and wording. And then it was able to put that into a document that I could highlight, copy, paste, but more importantly, I could set a shortcut on the Mac and just have it read that to me. So suddenly I was able to read all my assignments, you know, in a way that worked for me. So it was, and this is like, we're talking iPhone 4 days. So the fact that I was able to do that back in 2011, it was incredible. It was like, it was life-changing for me. So that then, you know, I to kind of just summarize this, I talked about that in that film, How Apple Saved My Life, and how it actually was able to help me get through school. I can guarantee you, I would not have graduated, and I graduated with a sliver. Like I'm just not academically very good, but two, it doesn't help that academics aren't accessible to me in the current format and form that, you know, they're done. And I wasn't set up for success. I didn't learn Braille as a kid. It wasn't my decision. I was too young to really make that decision. So someone made it for me. And I think I would have totally benefited from it because I can't read with my vision. So that's just another thing. But I talked about, again, how Apple impacted my life positively in a fact where I could get through school, education, and then pursue video editing because of just how accessible. One, their software, Apple makes video editing software, which is great. Final Cut Pro, iMovie, they're fine. They're fantastic, actually, especially Final Cut. And it works with Zoom. And when I need to turn on Zoom Speak or use VoiceOver, it works for that, especially on mobile, too, which is great. So, again, that's sort of why I made this video. I'm just like, I just wanted to share that story and not, like, make it seem like an ad for Apple, but I know it probably did come off as sort of like an ad. It wasn't. It definitely seems like I'm over giving my appreciation for Apple, but I just really wanted to highlight a company that was doing accessibility from the start and how that impacted me growing up, like my coming of age. And that, I think, it just kind of goes to show, and I hope people, when they watch it, they're like, how can I take this story or at least like that impact and bring it back into like my place of work, whatever it is you work on, services, whether it's a product design, whatever it might be, how can you make it more accessible and impactful for others? And so, yeah, again, that's sort of what was really cool. And then Apple saw it through it being shared amongst Mac blogs. And within 4 days, Tim Cook shared it on his Twitter, his personal Twitter. And that's kind of where that relationship started. And then the next year I was up there talking with him in person and having coffee, and he was letting me interview him. I was the first individual that wasn't a part of a media group or organization that was doing a sit down one-on-one interview with Tim Cook. And not to, you know, not give credit to Ricky Pointer and Tatiana Lee were also up there as well. And they're great representatives of the deaf community and the, you know, wheelchair users who, again, just great reps in our community who also had that same opportunity. I think they shared it on different kinds of platforms and did different kind of formats, but yeah, first group to interview Tim Cook, essentially.
I liked Apple before I got into the accessibility space, but after I got into the accessibility space, I do have a lot of respect for the company as well, because, you know, when you were talking about it, you were stating more or less facts and not being, because they do a great job with making things accessible. And they always do, you know, put accessibility first when they're trying to build products, which shows in a lot of things that they do. And when I was looking about you online was about gaming, you know, that is another thing that a lot of people who, you know, who have vision today realize that a lot of there are a lot of blind gamers out there. And I just wanted to briefly touch upon how did you get into gaming, because I was on your Twitch channel, which, you know, we will link in the description to the podcast, because, you know, I think your streams are really interesting. I was watching the stream the other day about how you were editing videos on Final Cut Pro and, you know, and the games that you play, and you do, you know, make those streams really interesting. And I was wondering, you know, what got you into gaming and what are some of the games that you play and how do you go about playing some of these games? Do these games also have some voiceover built in, or how are these games accessible? So for those who are probably sighted and don't have much of an idea, including myself, until I saw some of your videos, how are games made accessible? Because they seem to be so visually rich, right? So yeah, a little about that.
Sure. Yeah. So, my first memory is gaming, which is going back. We had Nintendo 64 and Game Boys in the house, but Pokemon actually, which is celebrating its 25th anniversary. So I share that age with Pokemon because it came out to the West here in the US around 97. And so I was about 2 to 3 years old when I picked it up. And again, it's my earliest memory. So the fact that it's stuck around this long is kind of like, it's kind of nice. It's nice having that, you know, that kind of outlet to go, like that form of entertainment always go back to. And Pokemon's always stayed pretty accessible with its gameplay. It's turn-based, so you take your time. It's like your character makes a move when you tell it to. And you don't take damage until you've made that move. So even though in theory, in the world of Pokemon, it's like supposed to be real time combat and stuff, or battles, it's in the game, it's just made accessible for me. And then back in the day, I think everyone had a hard time looking at Game Boy screens. Like they were 8-bit, they didn't have a backlight, and they were kind of tiny. So at least the screen part of it. So we had this big magnifier, my brother and I. So when I say we, brother and I, my brother's also visually impaired, but he's got better vision than me, but it still, you know, impacts his day to day. But we had this big magnifier with a light that you could flick on. And it would make the game just that much bigger and more accessible to view. And then kind of growing up, though, I played gaming passively. Pokemon was one big franchise I always kind of stuck with. I tried some other games, many of which, you know, don't come as easy to me without, you know, I don't have depth perception. My reflexes probably aren't as great compared to a lot of sighted gamers. because my vision and my brain's taking a bit more time to process what's happening, if it can even figure out what's visually occurring. And so I kind of fell out of gaming, I'll be honest, towards the beginning of this last generation, which was when I was sort of in high school. But I kind of fell out of it because I was going out of high school. I had other priorities. I was trying to figure out, what am I doing with my adult life? And then I moved to LA to save some money. I sold a couple game consoles I had back at home. And eventually, once I kind of got a footing, I'm like, I wouldn't mind playing Mario Kart and Smash Brothers with my friends, even though I'm bad at them. You know, just something fun to do. So I got a Wii U, which, rest in peace, that poor console never, it was the console that never could. It wasn't very popular. I don't think it was Nintendo's worst selling console, but it was at least a good experiment to what would become the Switch, which, I praise for especially visually impaired gamers. And I can talk about that in a second, but with the Wii U, I got like Mario Kart, Smash, and it kind of just pulled me back into it a little bit, especially a new game called Splatoon, which was a shooter. Shooters do not come easy for me. I'm just terrible. Try seeing me get a kill in Call of Duty. It probably never would happen. But Splatoon was this like very stylistic, cartoony game from Nintendo. And it was their take on a shooter, but like kind of taking the whole idea of a platformer and a shooter together. So you play as like this character who can turn into a squid and swim in ink that you shoot through like different kinds of weapons, and two colored inks. The opponents are also trying to ink turf, and you're trying to take over their turf. So it's like whoever puts down the most turf wins, but you're able to swim in your color ink. You can't swim in the other color ink, but it's very easy to see. So if you do have, you know, some degree of vision, you can probably play Splatoon to some degree, which, again, I have so much fun with that game. It is fast paced. It's these quick kind of 3-minute games, and you're just but it can be pretty casual too. Most people that play in the casual ranks aren't the best, so it's like you can have fun with it. And that came out again for the Switch. The Switch came. It was this handheld game console, which I did play. Like again, I played Pokemon. That was handheld, but I was having a hard time seeing Pokemon games, to be honest. Always kind of have. So when they're on the DS, I'd always play along with someone. You know, there's always these people who played online on YouTube or Twitch, and I turn on their playthrough as I'm playing, because they would just read everything to me. It was like, you know, I'm able to enjoy the dialogue of the game without having to strain my eyes. And I learned all the sounds. Each attack had a different move. Each Pokemon had a different cry it made when it came out into battle and stuff. So and there's like little sound effects too in that game, like when you hit a wall you hear a little thud noise. And I know a totally blind gamer who is able to like play some classic grid-based Pokemon games just because of the sounds, which is really cool based on memory and walkthroughs. And so from there I just got more into gaming again with the Switch. They added a zoom feature, which I can zoom in to any game, which is great. They invert colors, grayscale. And a lot of Nintendo games are just very stylistic looking, like Splatoon, Mario, the new Zelda, and there's Pokemon again, of course. And then, you know, I'd always been kind of curious about games on other consoles, and I played some, not well, but on and off. And I went to E3 one year as a speaker, talk about accessibility in gaming. And I happened to speak on stage with reps from Sony and Microsoft, and I got to hear a bit more about what they're doing. It was really cool. And funny enough, Nintendo was kind of missing from the accessibility discussion. And they kind of still are today, to be honest. I wish they would be a little bit more involved with the community. They have some good blueprints on accessibility, but they also have a lot of inconsistency with technical accessibility.
Mm-hmm.
But that aside, that's a bigger conversation for another day. But then Sony was like, hey, we really liked what you had to say. We're working on a game. It's a AAA action adventure shooter game. Love to come have you and consult on like what we have so far, and maybe we can try and make this like more accessible to blind low vision gamers.
Mm-hmm.
I said, yeah, I'd love to, you know, check it out. And again, I'm not very good with these kinds of games because they're kind of new to me, but I got to come in and work on this game called The Last of Us Part 2 multiple times over the last couple of years, and keep giving feedback on the accessibility, give some suggestions on what could improve and what I couldn't see, what I could see. And what actually just kind of worked out for me is I could play with like my eyes shut when my eyes are too tired. And you can play that game with just sound, and it's a 3D environment, which is really kind of wild. And that game, as you were kind of mentioning before, it's like what games have kind of like a screen reader built in. Well, The Last of Us Part II, from the moment you boot up the game, it will start talking to you. You can turn that off immediately if you're, you know, not visually impaired. But if you leave it on, then you can choose from different accessibility presets, and then you can go customize all those. So if you have hearing accessibility needs, if you have vision accessibility needs, if you have physical accessibility needs, you can adjust all those. And there's so much packed in there. It's like, I really can't list it all. I recently did a video about what I can and can't see while gaming. And I cover The Last of Us, and I think I try to tackle some detail, but it was like, I couldn't go in depth because that video would have been like 45 minutes to an hour long. And, you know, there's already some good resources out there of like, on how to do that or you know, play with the accessibility and on Sony support sites. But anyway, it's an incredible achievement. And that game not only won Game of the Year from the Game Awards, but it won for innovation in accessibility, a new category to try and recognize game developers who are trying to make their games accessible, which is great because that's hopefully going to influence more game developers to want to try and compete in that category.
Yeah.
But two, it's like the number one AAA game of last year that had a huge budget, but decided to allocate a lot of that budget to accessibility. It paid off. You know, it wasn't just Game of the Year. It was or accessibility Game of the Year. It was the Game of the Year. So I think developers can look at that and be like, okay, we can design with accessibility in mind and still have a Game of the Year. It's like, yeah, because an accessible game is a better game. I think that that's plain and simple.
So thanks for those insights on gaming, James. I completely agree with you. And as an avid video gamer myself, I would definitely love to see video games becoming more accessible. I would love to see all software becoming more inclusive and accessible, because I believe that when software developers pay attention to concepts like accessibility and inclusiveness, it definitely benefits all users, not just people who rely on accessible software. On that note, I want to wrap up this conversation, but before that, I have one last question for you, and it's a question that I have for all our guests. What is your mantra? You know, what is your guiding principle in life, and what would you like to share to with our listeners before we wrap this thing up? Over to you.
Yeah, for me, it's, you know, I respect everyone and where they are on their journey with sight loss or disability. And I want to respect where, you know, everyone will be. But for me, what I can kind of just share personally, if you want to take my two cents, again, don't have to, but I've gotten to this point based on my experience from several years of living it, trying to fix it, resources not really being there to try to fix it, and the ones that I did ultimately didn't work after a few years. But pretty much just live today and try and make today as accessible as possible, because you may not have a fixed tomorrow. I think that's pretty much, there's a lot of people who hope that there's gonna be a cure or treatment or a medical miracle that will occur for giving them the ability to see 20/20 again, or just even just see more. It may not happen. Eyes are very complicated. There's people, of course, working on that, and I'll leave those up to the medical professionals. But for me, if I ever like do charity events or do any kind of like fundraising, it's always going to go towards accessibility, because that's what I think we really need to focus on now, is making our society more accessible, both digitally and in physical spaces. And so I'd rather take those funds and you know, make it more accessible, because people are going to lose their sight every day. You know, people are going to be born without sight every day. And even if cures do come around, treatments do come around, it's going to be for the very few privileged that can afford that, or, you know. So it's just, I think accessibility is the best investment over a medical model that may never actually happen.
Thank you for those wise words, James. Taking each day as it comes and making the most of today and the opportunities that it presents is definitely a worthwhile mantra for all of us to follow. You've been a huge inspiration to a lot of people, and definitely a huge inspiration to the people at Envision. So many thanks for doing the podcast with us today and sharing a little bit more about your world and your life as a filmmaker, a video gamer, a tech enthusiast, and an overall awesome person. Thank you everyone else for listening in on today's episode. We really hope you enjoyed our talk with James Rutt. For more such inspiring conversations, stay tuned, and we'll be back with a new episode very, very soon.